I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Guys, guess what?
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 As we're recording this,
I guess two announcements I got. Number one, as we're recording this, by the time this comes out, I'm going to say, like, chances are very high that, Taylor, you're going to be a dad of a second child.
Oh, yeah. What date is this coming out?
This is coming out. Here's the second announcement. I'm working into this. This is coming out the day before Rare Disease Day.
Oh,
February 28th.
That is the date that this releases. That's right. Rare Disease Day is tomorrow, February 29th. And actually, today's episode, we're speaking with a young woman who has a rare disease. And we're going to get to it. Very excited. Jordan was a lovely guest, but before we get to that, Taylor,
congratulations.
How did the birth giving go?
Wow.
What do you call that? How did the
delivery?
Go? Yeah.
Okay. Just one second. I'm accessing an astral projection.
But actually, Don, if you could just add some astral projection sound here, that'd be great.
Wow. Intense.
Wow.
It was intense. And very graphic.
Wow. Do you have a video that you can send me again?
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
So we're recording this a couple of weeks out, but Kyla's like about to burst. Did you say she's 10 centimeters dilated?
No,
or
no.
That's the max?
10 centimeters is like...
10 centimeters, ready to go.
10 centimeters is like the baby is coming any moment.
Yeah. Hurry. Hut.
Yeah.
Hut 1, 2. Hut.
Yeah.
Hut. Hut.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
she's currently 3 centimeters, QB, or at least she was.
The QB is about to call the snap.
Right. Yeah.
For all you football fans,
it's a really slow motion snap.
Yeah, a very slow motion snap, and she is she's currently, as we sit right now,
probably
two,
an effective strategy.
2 or 3 centimeters dilated, which means coming
at any moment now. She could ship that
moment.
Baby out.
Yep.
Let's see. Cool. Well, congrats, Tay.
Yeah, very excited.
You know, it's been really beautiful to watch you grow into the father role over the past couple of years.
I'm so organized.
You've been doing a really great job, and so just don't fuck this one up.
Yeah. My favorite part is how you've just incorporated spanking us, me and Brian, when we're naughty.
Well, I read a lot of books, and they all kind of
said you can't do it to your daughter, but do it to your best friends.
They all kind of point towards spanking as an effective tool child management.
I don't know if I told you this, Jared, but Taylor and I talked at length about him spanking me because it's actually been part of my therapy journey.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to reintegrate.
Why? Because your therapist doesn't want to spank you over Zoom?
No, it's because spanking for me was really traumatic as a child. And so I'm now trying to rebuild my neural pathways and my relationships with spanking. So.
Okay.
Because
you know how I know you're a liberal, Bri?
Why?
Continue.
But anyway, it's been
spanking
really effective.
Is really traumatic for me.
All right, Trudeau.
Now I've been able to.
Hey, serious question though, guys. We obviously Brian was spanked. He just said it. Were you spanked?
Were you actually spanked?
Yeah, I was spanked. I was spanked a lot.
My mom did spank me a couple times, like with like a wooden spoon. I think. My mom did actually fucking wallop me with a spoon when I didn't even know I didn't even realize what I was doing, but we lived in this trailer park. What?
Obviously.
What?
You're just the way you're painting the picture.
You know, you know how I know that I'm a conservative? just kidding. So we lived in this trailer park and I went on like an adventure with my buddy in the neighborhood and we made our way out of the trailer park to this like main road, this junction.
Wow, what a magical experience.
Yeah. And he turns to me and he goes, "Hey, do you want to hitch?" We were like four, maybe even four. He goes, "Hey, do you want to hitchhike?" And I was like, "Yeah." how do you do it? And he goes, you just put your thumb up. And we put our thumbs up, and we were trying to hitchhike.
Oh, yeah. I did that.
A neighbor saw us, pulled over, and was like, guys, come on, get in the car. We got in the car. We were like, yeah, we got picked up. Drives us home. He tells my mom, oh, man, she was livid. And I remember a wooden spoon cracking off my ass. And listen, anybody listening to this, don't judge my mother. Those were different times. And look at me now. A staunch right-wing, libtard, cuck-hating.
You know what? We're tearing down fascists. We're tearing down statues. So, we're tearing down parents. Okay, yeah. Nobody gets a free pass here. Everybody gets judged by today's standards, goodness. No matter what.
Especially you, Maxine.
That's right.
The sweetest woman on the planet.
I was spanked. I remember being spanked a few times.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It didn't last.
I could see the vein popping into Don's head as he's just giving it to you.
Didn't last very long. I remember we used to go to church, which is interesting to me in hindsight that we ever went to church. But my dad's side of the family, my dad's mother, my grandmother, like is just like the picture of like, I've gone to church every day for my whole life. You know, you go into the house, you know, Jesus with the open heart photo, like in every room.
The open heart photo.
You know what I mean?
Heart.
You know, right.
I believe it's the bleeding.
Yeah,
heart.
I mean, fuck, whatever. I didn't pay attention in Sunday school. So, like,
Jesus
whatever
in
fuck
the
that
CVICU.
Is. Lots of Marys. Marys everywhere. So many Marys, so many Josephs. And I was being a little hellion in church one day. And
you got spanked in church?
No, I got brought out to the car.
Oh, yeah. Oh shit. Nice.
It was, nice. We're leaving. Nice. And
it's all
gonna,
your fault.
Hey. You're not going to like it.
Yeah.
Great way to get out of church, though.
You know what? It's funny. When I think of my totally parents spanking it. Me, like, I feel like I feared my mom more. Like, she's a much smaller woman than my dad is a human. And
your mom is a fierce.
But she was fierce. And the funny thing is, like, when I think of my dad spanking me, I think of him, like, having the attitude of, like, oh, like, I guess I just got to do this. Like, he never really seemed mad when he was doing it. He just kind of seemed like he was, like,
your mom was
just
like,
doing it. My
your mom
was
like the Putin. That directs the
that's too much politics.
The military right to invade.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the first thing Wednesday morning.
She doesn't actually have to crack the whip, but she gives the orders.
Well, speaking of spanking, I'm going to spank the two of you if you don't shut the fuck up, because none of this has anything to do with today's discussion. Again, it is Rare Disease Week. Tomorrow is Rare Disease Day. And today we are leading into a beautiful conversation with Jordan Campbell, who lives with hereditary angioedema, also known as HAE. And if you're anything like me or Brian, who took part in the conversation, we had no idea what the hell that was all about. And Jordan is a wonderful voice in the world of advocacy for rare disease. And she did a lovely job walking us through her experience with HAE. So without further ado, enjoy this conversation with our new friend, Jordan. Okay, Brian, just you and I. It's a big old fucking snow day here in Halifax.
I should have waited to say this after the show, but that's a fucking sick sweater that you're wearing.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, and I bet that people who are just listening to this can maybe see that sweater over on our social media if you check out the video clip from this episode.
Yeah, that's right.
Just saying.
Maybe YouTube if we put it up there. Who knows? Maybe we'll start doing that. I didn't even ask our guest today. Jordan, are you cool if we throw this up on YouTube?
Of course, go ahead.
Thank God. So Bri, it's just us. Taylor's not here today. He is it's a snow day, and so he is with his daughter, because evidently when the snow falls too much, everything closes except for Sick Boy Studios.
Exactly. We're here on the grind.
That's it. And daddy is at home taking care of the baby, because the baby didn't have daycare.
But uncles are here.
That's it. The uncles are in town.
We're ready to record.
And we are joined by our new friend, Jordan Campbell, all the way from Brampton. And Jordan is going to be talking to us about something that I can almost guarantee you've never heard of, because I definitely have never heard of it. And I would be shocked if you have. Okay. I'm going to give my best effort at my best attempt at saying it without fucking it up, okay? We're going to be talking about hereditary angioedema.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
All right, yeah. Let's go.
Okay.
Now, what is that, Brian? What is, it's also known as HAE.
Okay, so hereditary. We know that you got it from your mama or your
or
your father.
Yeah, who knows?
Or or like somewhere in the tree.
Somewhere, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I feel like I've heard the words on this podcast before. Angioedema. But I don't know what it is. Jordan, what is that?
Right. So you probably have heard of angioedema before because it is kind of a broad term for it pretty much means swelling. But this is a genetic kind of swelling that comes from swelling of the blood vessels.
Ooh.
Yes, I know. We all look confused.
Bad.
So how does that happen? How does that look? So hereditary angioedema kind of manifests in multiple different ways. I think for pretty much everyone who's been diagnosed with the disease, it looks different in every single person. So it is swelling, severe swelling, but of several different parts of the body. So it can be the limbs, so hands, arms, feet, your legs, your thighs. It can also go to your face, your throat. Intestines, and when it's your intestines, it's obviously that's not visual. That pretty much looks like you have the flu. It's like flu-like symptoms, nonstop vomiting. And the only way to get this swelling to go down is, well, obviously with medication, but if you don't have medication, then you're kind of sitting with this swelling for about 3 to 5 days.
Ooh. Wow. You know, I'm not one to pass up a lazy river analogy.
You sure aren't.
And to me, this it sounds. I can imagine how bad this is based on picturing a lazy river. So like you have this like nice river
I'm
where
so
there's
sorry,
all these.
Jordan, I'm so sorry.
There's all these tubes that are floating down it, and the tubes are the blood vessels, and the people are riding around on these little tubes.
Yeah.
Except your tubes aren't little tubes; they're swelling up, and so they're big tubes. And so I can imagine that if those tubes get too big, then all of a sudden you're having this traffic jam of tubes in different parts of your body. And it sounds like it's happening like at the ends of your extremities and all these other places. So it's like the tubes get to these points where they're like, oh fuck. It's like, it's
yeah,
chaos.
Okay, all right.
And so that sounds
sure
bad. I have no idea what that means, but I can picture it and it sounds bad.
I will jump in and say, I don't think Jordan mentioned her tubes once, but,
no, the tubes are the blood, the tubes.
Oh, I see.
Are the tubes are in the lazy river.
Oh, yeah.
Those
okay.
are the tubes that the humans are rafting on.
Oh, okay. Not her literal tubes.
No, not her tubes. Jordan, how accurate is that?
I'm picking it up. I understand what you're saying. I'm getting it.
And, yes, and is it right?
it is correct. So pretty much like I remember. So the first time it happened to me, I'm 28 now. So the first time this ever happened to me, I was 16 years old, getting ready to go to school one day. And my hand was like a little bit swollen. You know, it wasn't too bad, but it was hurting. And then by the end of the school day, my hand was so swollen, like I could not move any of my fingers. It pretty much was like the size of a softball.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, and you can't move it. And then once it starts traveling up your whole arm and you'll you lose the ability to use your entire arm for like 3 days.
Wow.
That sounds super scary.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've never had a severe allergic reaction to anything before. But I've definitely had some like skin stuff come up, and like skin stuff is like super fucking annoying. And there's also like a really unsettling element to it when you don't know what it's from. But swelling is one thing, but your entire hand leading to your entire arm swelling out of seemingly nowhere. So like, you know, not tied to like an insect bite or anything like that. That sounds like, you know, sometimes you'll talk to people about like recurring nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And one that I feel like is really common is people have like a weird recurring nightmare, where like their teeth fall out or something. Whoa. Right. And it's like, if you took that dream reality and brought it into, you know, consensus reality, that would incite some panic, I would believe.
Yeah.
I feel like if all of a sudden, you know, if like I was having a dream about, you know, my arm just starts swelling out of fucking nowhere, and it gets that swollen over the course of a day. That sounds like one of those like awful body horror nightmares.
And I think unsettling is a really great word, because like if you get stung by a bee and
you know what to expect,
you start to swell up. Yeah. You're like, oh, I know why this is.
Right.
But like swelling in general is like this like red flag that something's going on in your body that's bad. But when you don't know what that's coming from, unsettling.
Unless it's like right after going to the gym and like, you know, your delts are swollen and your biceps.
Again, you know why that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that swell. okay. So that sounds crazy. You're 16. You've got this, your arm has literally turned into like, it sounds like you were just like slowly becoming the Michelin Man.
That's exactly what was happening.
What kind of reaction are you like? And I mean, like what kind of personal reaction do you have to this? Who do you bring it to, and how the fuck do they react?
So I was a very sick kid growing up. Like I was always in the hospital, and I was also a dancer, so I was always hurting myself. Pretty much my family chalked it up to like a spider biting me or I hurt myself. Until it happened like 2 weeks later to the other arm. And it's like, well, no. Okay. I freaked out. I was very much saying there was something wrong. I went to the doctors and they pretty much said that I had a peanut allergy. And I didn't eat peanuts. I hated peanut butter. I never went near it. So it didn't make sense to me. But everyone in my family was like, yeah, it's a peanut allergy. Everyone was like, it's peanut allergy. So I was like, okay. And it just continued to happen. Honestly, all throughout high school, maybe every 2 weeks, once a month, one hand would swell up and it would be accompanied by the vomiting, but everyone was just like, no, it's peanuts.
Did they say, were they like, you probably kissed someone who had peanut butter? Because I feel like that was like a big fear for me in like high school, was like, if I had peanut butter and then I kiss somebody, like, was I gonna, were they gonna be allergic to peanut butter?
Oh, is you just then, kissing people on a daily act as a daily activity in high school?
You know, like, I believe in like, if they consent to it, then like,
sure, yeah, right,
you know, like, it's a nice way to show affection for a friend.
Right. In high school. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. But like,
Waldorf school or something? That sounds so fucking like progressive, dude.
Jordan,
holy shit.
Like, Jordan, did anybody, because like, if you didn't have peanut butter yourself,
I'm sorry, no, like, where did no, they no think one you're suggested getting it. I'm sure my doctor thought it, but no one said it out loud like you are doing.
I mean, it's just a hunch. Maybe I'm onto something.
So here's another thing that, here's another thing that I'll just like, I'll throw out there. So I didn't know HAE prior to setting up this recording, and I did a little bit of reading. And for any of the nerds out there that are listening, I know there's a lot of nerds that love this show, a lot of medical nerds. If you are one of those nerds like us, I'm saying like us because I don't want anybody to think that I'm getting like derogatory here. HAE is an autosomal dominant disease. Do you know what that means?
You got it from
who?
Your papa.
I don't know. I actually don't know. I'm not that much of a
wait,
fucking nerd.
Wait, no. That has to do with
autosomal dominant.
One carrier, one person, either your mom or dad were a carrier, and it was a dominant gene from them.
Autosomal means that the gene in question is located on one of the numbered or non-sex chromosomes. Dominant means that a single copy of the mutated gene from one parent is enough to cause the disorder. All right, there we go.
I think that like what I said was right, right?
I actually don't even know what I just read. But
Jordan, how does that sound?
But wait. Before we go down that road. So it's an autosomal dominant disease caused by either, okay, this is kind of interesting, either a lack of C1 inhibitor protein or dysfunctional C1 inhibitor protein, which brings me back around to where I wanted to go with this, which is that it is considered a rare disease, right, Jordan?
Yes.
How rare are we talking?
I think it's 1 in 50,000 Canadians.
Okay, that's
really
rare. Yeah. And the interesting part about this, and especially just thinking about this from like a perspective of like, you know, so Jordan, just for context, right now we're in the midst of putting together another podcast series for Cystic Fibrosis Canada. And a big part of that series, we were like getting into the hard headed nerdy science behind like what the fuck is happening in the human body to create this thing. And it all stems from a genetic disorder that affects one single protein of the body.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a very similar situation here where there's one tiny little aspect of our machine is just out of, you know, the wrong shape. It was like the wrong screw didn't fit into the hole, but someone rammed it in. And now it's causing this trickle down effect that leads to all these fucking issues. And I know that for some rare diseases, like cystic fibrosis, 99% of the time, especially today in current, you know, the current day that we live in, it's pretty quick and pretty easy to get a diagnosis of CF. But I also know that for a lot of rare diseases, especially like the really rare diseases, getting down to a diagnosis is an absolute bitch of a process. And some people can go years without receiving a proper diagnosis. I'm curious to know, when you were 16 and the first thing you were told was, it's probably a peanut allergy. That doesn't sound very promising to getting a very quick diagnosis. So like, what did that journey look like for you? Maybe take us through like from your, you know, from the best of your recollection, like what was that process of getting down to the fact that, okay, this is actually something that is due to a C1 inhibitor protein?
So it's a lot scarier than you would probably think. And from what I remember it was like the worst time of my entire life. But all throughout high school, I was pretty much told the same thing. There was nothing wrong with me. I spent every Christmas in the hospital just with norovirus or just like flu-like symptoms. And by the time I graduated high school and no one in the GTA, no hospital could really help me, I kind of got sick and tired, and I applied to university 4 hours north, and I just moved away. I moved 4 hours away, and I was like, maybe someone up here could help me. And I remember telling my roommates my first week that this thing happens to me. I get really, really sick. And Frosh week, that first week of university, one of my roommates had to take me in a taxi to the hospital because I was pretty much unresponsive on my bedroom floor, and they had just met me. First year university,
I had a similar experience during Frosh week, but for different reasons.
You motherfucker.
Alcoholic? Sorry, hey, sorry. You know what? My doctors thought, they thought that I had alcohol poisoning. So that's why they thought I was in the ER.
Oh, wow.
But that was not the case. Wow. All throughout my first year of university, I was in the ER a lot, but they actually were trying to do testing on me, different testing than I was getting at home. I was being tested for what I can remember was bone cancer. They were debating on taking out my appendix and my gallbladder at one point because they thought that was what was making me sick. Went through a bunch of different diagnoses. And then once I was in my fourth year of university, 4 years of just being sick all the time, hundreds of hospital stays. I had this cough that wasn't going away, and I woke up one morning and my throat was swollen. My face was kind of swollen. I just didn't look right. And my voice was like an octave lower. And I tried getting a doctor's appointment, and I couldn't really get one till like 4 p.m. So I waited the whole day trying to see a doctor. I see this doctor, and the doctor just called the hospital immediately. And I got sent to the ICU in North Bay. And within like 45 minutes, they pretty much had to put me on. They had to intubate me. So I was put on life support. And I was like that for 5 days. And that is what led me to my diagnosis.
Whoa.
Holy shit. Wow. That's such a, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes for that time. And I imagine it's really frustrating constantly being sick and going to the hospital and like doing a lot of people when they're in those positions, like, you know, they'll either put off like going to the hospital or like because they just kind of lose faith.
And I was at that point. And I think that's why I ended up getting so sick, because I was putting it off. And they would blame it on, you know, like smoking weed or like drinking or, you know, like it felt like I was being blamed for being sick. I actually did stop. I stopped going to the hospital. I stopped actually reaching out for care.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what it felt like emotionally, getting to that point of like having to go into the ICU? Did you have like feelings about, you know, the hospital and seeing doctors at that point? Can you remember what that felt like?
Well, I just remember that day in particular, it felt like people actually cared. It felt like people were listening to me. So it wasn't like I wasn't scared of the hospital. There was no fear because the nurses, everyone was taking me so seriously. So it wasn't that. It was just being told, like, you know, like I thought I was going in with like a sore throat, you know. I had a cheerleading. I was on the cheerleading team. I was supposed to be going to Montreal that weekend for, you know, nationals. And it was the Wednesday that this was happening. So, you know, I thought I was just going to be good, get some antibiotics. And that's just obviously not what happened. So I just remember being really scared to, you know, be intubated because I didn't really understand what that meant at that time. And then 5 days pass and you just, you know, you have no idea what happened.
Mm-hmm. How did they explain that to you? Like when, because, you know, I've been able to like understand what being intubated is by hearing people like you tell their stories and talk about that experience. And I imagine if I didn't have any knowledge of being intubated and I had this, you know, nurse or doctor or professional speaking to me and telling me about what that might be like, I imagine it would be like incredibly terrifying. What was that like?
I didn't understand. I now going back, trying to put myself in that room and like they were telling me, and I didn't understand. I didn't understand what it meant. And I don't think even till after it was over with and I went home, I didn't even really understand what happened.
Mm-hmm. Did they, so when you came out of being intubated after those 5 days, did you get answers then?
No. So the people who were looking after me at the hospital, they couldn't figure out what happened. They pretty much just intubated me until the swelling went down, but they couldn't figure out why the swelling was there and how to get it to go down. So that's why I was it was only supposed to be like 24 hours, 48 hours, and then it ended up being 5 days. So they didn't really understand what happened. And they asked me, you know, you have to dig deeper, like you might have an autoimmune disease. They went through my whole medical history and they didn't understand why I'd been so sick my whole life. So, I went home and my aunt works at a hospital in Mississauga, and she ended up going around her hospital to the immunology, to all these different doctors that she had never met before and that she had met before. And they had given the suggestion to do the C1S raise test. And that's where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's wild about that to me is that I actually heard a really great clip from, the YouTube doctor, Dr. Mike, the other day, talking about...
Is he like the handsome guy that Pamela is like has been on his show?
I think so.
Yeah.
And he was talking about, you know, when a patient comes into his office, this is something only like recently that he's like sort of learned to do, and he feels like it's really helpful for patients. It's something that he didn't think about or wasn't taught during his medical training. But he now asks the people who come into his office who he doesn't have answers for. He's like, if I tell you that there's something wrong with you and I don't know what it is, but I just sort of like validate the fact that you're experiencing this and send you on your way, like, is that enough for you? Or do you need sort of like extra, you know, do you need to come back and see me? And do we need to keep pursuing this? Because sometimes people just need to like be heard and told that, you know, like, yeah, you are sick right now. We don't know exactly what it is, but like, you know, if you go home and you rest and try to do these things and take care of yourself and feel better, then like, will that be good enough for you? And if they say yes, then that's fine. But if they say no, then he knows that he needs to continue seeing them and keep working on that. And it makes me think of like your situation, Jordan, where, you know, like you've been in the ICU for 5 fucking days and like they basically at the end of that don't have any answers for you. And did it feel like they were just sort of like sending you off going like, well, you know, like we've gotten you back to a stable place. Like, good luck. Hope that doesn't happen again. Did you feel at that point that like it had reached such a breaking point that they were like, okay, there needs to be some sort of plan to like follow up and figure out what the fuck is going on with you. Cause like talking about, you know, getting your aunt to help out, it sounds like there wasn't even a clear plan at that point.
Yeah, no, they were pretty much like, we don't know what's wrong with you. Like my mom kind of just felt like they sent us on our way and, you know, we kind of just went home. Yeah, no, there wasn't really any plan to, like, no one ever suggested that they were going to, like, dig deeper and figure out what it was. So I'm glad that somehow I was able to figure out what it was. And I just got lucky, I think.
Mm-hmm. When your aunt was sort of advocating for you, and they looked into like what sort of approach did they take to identify what was going on compared to like all of the other times that you had been to the hospital?
I think it was the particular doctor that she went to talk to about this. The one that she went to, he was explaining the symptoms, and I guess she had never talked to him about it before. And this doctor in particular, he said, well, there's this test, the C1 esterase deficiency test, and I run it on all my patients that come through, but I've never seen anyone with it come back positive. And she told him to do it, and I'm the only patient he's ever had that it came back positive. But he said that he ran it on everyone just because it was a free test, and when he was running blood samples, why not run it?
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating.
I'm just kind of curious about how your, you know, how something like this sort of, and maybe from the point both from, you know, like prior to a diagnosis and then after diagnosis, because I know that, you know, I know through speaking with people on the show for almost a decade, like there's sort of like the you before diagnosis and the you after, especially with folks that have like had that extended period of time where they didn't know what was going on. Whether it's prior to receiving the diagnosis or after, how is this affecting your sort of day to day? You know, like how often were you experiencing, sort of, I guess, like flare ups or whatever, you know, whatever term you'd use, and on top of that, like, how did that in turn affect your interpersonal relationships, whether that's, you know, romantic relationships or friendships or family, like those types of things?
So for me, I had attacks pretty much once a month, and that went on, you know, from when I was 16 all the way to 21. So it was very much like a part of my life. The most part that it affected the most was working as a university student. Like, I was a server, and your hand swells up, you can't hold the tray anymore. So that was really frustrating to me. I found work to be the worst, but I had a really understanding owner of the restaurant. He had Crohn's disease, and he was very understanding. So I just had to show him my hand, or if I felt sick or something, he actually would just put me in his truck and drive me straight home. He was very understanding. So I got lucky with that as well. Relationship-wise, it was very strange because sexual intercourse, another part that I didn't tell you, your genitals can swell up. So imagine just, you know, like trying to have a one-night stand in university, and then the next day you're swollen, and it's not even that swells, then it travels down your legs all the way down to your ankles. And so, oh, like, God, you're quite literally unable to walk for like 3 days because your legs don't work anymore and your ankles don't bend anymore. And so that was just something I tried to avoid, honestly, in university, just because it would literally take me out of school, it would take me out of cheerleading, it would take me out of everything. So there was that. And then once you get your diagnosis, right, I was devastated. And it's so funny to look at now, like, why was I devastated? Because my life was pretty miserable, and I was miserable all the time. And I don't, you know, now I just have a needle that I have to do, you know, every week, and you do your needle and you don't experience any symptoms at all. It's such a like 180 from what my life was before. So yeah, there is definitely a before diagnosis, Jordan, and then after.
Wow. So just back to the like experience with your sex life.
Yeah.
Is the swelling a direct result of something in particular? What are the things that trigger it? Like,
so there's multiple triggers.
Were you having that experience because, you know, of like the closeness of sex? And so it's like a repetitive sort of friction or whatever is causing the HAE to like act up in that moment at that specific spot?
Yeah, there's multiple reasons why it starts. So like, there's never really a pinpoint, but I mean, trauma to the body is one. And then, and so I assume it's just, you know, like just too much of a repeated action that body acts like it's being traumatized. And so it begins to swell. There's allergies. I just like, you know, like if I got like a carpet burn or something like that, that would make my hand swell up. If my, you know, ex's cat scratched me, like that would make my hand swell up. So it didn't even have to be like hard force. Something really, really small would trigger it.
Mm-hmm. Did you know, like, were there moments where like something would happen and you'd be like, oh,
here
fuck.
We go.
Like this is gonna,
was pretty, no, it was like,
it's going to go.
It was like every time I had sex, it would happen. So it was that it was, I just tried to avoid doing it because I, you know, the next morning. Yeah. Or you had to do it on a Thursday or Friday. So you have the weekend to like lie there and you're not missing school.
I wasn't specifically asking about sex in that situation too, but like if you like walked by a cupboard and like bumped your hand on the cupboard and you're like,
yeah,
oh yeah, fuck, yeah, like I'm not gonna be able to work tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you stub your toe or something.
Yeah. Damn, that would fuck. That would be the worst.
Yeah,
literally,
brutal.
It's like, I mean, the like, littlest thing.
And is this, you know, because this is hereditary, is there, you know, after getting the diagnosis, was there, did you have that experience with your family where, you know, there was kind of like a, oh yeah, in retrospect, you know, like grandma got like would swell up with those types of things, or like, you know, like is it like, oh yeah, we can kind of pinpoint that this is in the family and has been, but we just never really looked at it that way, or are you like, you know, are you patient zero in the Campbell family?
I was patient zero up until the X. And then a couple months, well, my sister had been diagnosed with IBS for years. They kept telling her she had IBS. So about a month or two after my diagnosis, her arm swelled up for the first time. So then she was number two to be diagnosed. And then I guess, well, we had both my parents do a genetic test and we forced my dad to do it. My dad doesn't live with us anymore. So we had forced him to do it. He agreed to participate. And then I guess like a year and a half, 2 years after participating in the genetic test, it came back that he was actually the carrier. And about a year after that, he started, you know, experiencing symptoms. So now he's actually all the in the hospital and quite ill now. But yeah, so my mom, my wow. dad and my sister have it.
You mentioned that that like the treatment is a needle. But also you said that when you were diagnosed that it was a bit of a shock for you. Like how did they know what the treatment plan would be right from the point of diagnosis?
Yeah. So the day I was diagnosed, the doctor had a treatment plan for me. Back then it was IVs. So I had a nurse that had to come to my house twice a week to give me IVs. My sister tried. We all got trained to do IVs. We were not successful in finding the vein. It was very hard. My sister was I remember my sister. She was like, no, I can do it. I can do it. And I remember her stabbing herself in the arm and her face just went white. And like, you know, she hit the wrong place completely. And she's like, okay, yeah, I guess we need a nurse.
Oh, fuck.
So for like 2 years, we had a nurse come twice a week. And then I was granted, what's it called? I can't remember what it's called. But the manufacturer of a new drug pretty much gave it to me as a gift because I was like a trial run in Canada for it, which was just a needle in your leg. And I've been on that since 2019.
What's it called? Compassionate?
Yes. Compassionate care. Compassionate
yeah,
care case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's wild that you were trained to give yourselves IVs.
That's pretty like, cool. They come not, with like Jared, the whole imagine? Staff to train you.
My anxiety is through the roof just having just over the last 2 minutes. I've got a thing with needles.
I hate needles too, but I
intravenous needles specifically.
No, I hate that. I also hate them. I still have to. I do it once a week, and I try putting it off as much as I can. It sucks.
So you do it yourself, and now we're at a point where whether it's through your particular situation or through advancement in treatment, like it's more of a, it's just a shot. Is that correct? And it's like, and you do this once a week yourself?
Yeah. So that, yeah. And definitely just in my case, 'cause my sister is really different. She's still, She's on a different medication, but she has to take it every single day because she's still very, very poor. My dad also didn't do very well with this medication, so he's on something different, and there's a lot more needles to that. So for me, this one has worked for me, and I haven't had any issues or any attacks in a few years now. And it's, yeah, just a needle that has to go on my leg.
How life-changing is it to know what you have and then get that medication?
It's, well, I mean, I haven't been to the hospital in years. And if I look back at 21, if I ever thought, oh, I'm never going to be in the hospital again, like I thought I was going to be sick forever. Because from when I was a kid, that's just my whole life was always being in the hospital. So it's like completely life-changing for me to have something, to know what it is, to be able to like wear it on my wrist and explain it to someone. And if I'm sick in the hospital, if it comes to the point where my throat's swelling again, like I can go to the hospital. I say what I tell them what medication I need. I can, you know, direct them instead of, you know, being all confused and everyone just being like, are you sure? So, yeah, it just feels, I don't know. I feel confident in myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you, when you're giving yourself injections, do you ever make jokes about, like say that you're taking steroids or things like that? Because if I was doing that, I would make that joke all the time.
Yeah. Oh, would you?
Yeah. To the point where it'd be really annoying for everybody.
Yeah, I'm already annoyed that you even asked that question.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Jordan. You can answer.
I mean, like as a guy, I get it. I feel like a guy would say that. A girl, I don't think you know what steroids do to girls. So I don't really know if that's something I would say. However, the first treatment for AHE was steroids.
Okay.
Interesting. Like prednisone or something.
Like actual like anabolic steroids. Like.
Way!
That
whoa,
was
crazy.
The very first treatment. Wow. So, yeah. Well.
Holy fuck! And were people just getting jacked up on?
So
on
my dad,
HAE meds?
When he was younger, he did steroids, and so he had this disease, and I think he honestly delayed symptoms for years and years and years because he was treating for himself for something he didn't know he had.
Wow.
You heard it here, folks. Steroids.
Wow. Not as bad as they seem.
They might be really good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Jordan said it. Jordan's saying it right now on air. Advocating for young people to start taking steroids because you never know.
That's the biggest thing I've taken.
I'm not saying it, but hey, you know.
HAE certified.
that's a fun. Did you get jacked? Like actually, did you ever get did you have to do drug testing for cheerleading?
No, right. We didn't have to do that.
Okay, were you like, were you a base throwing people in the
air? No, I was the person being thrown in the air. But I like that you know that it's a base throwing the people in the air.
Yeah, did you do tumbling?
I did, yes.
Yeah, cool. Did you do that thing where you like stretch your leg up and like put your arm through like you're shooting an arrow type of thing?
What the fuck, Brian? Were you a cheerleader? What's going on here?
No, but I think it's cool. And I watched, what was that cheerleading
movie? I watched a lot of football.
What was that cheerleading movie?
Bring It On?
Bring It On. Fuck yeah.
I was going to say Stomp the Yard, but it's definitely not that.
Are you tired of hearing the same old wellness advice? It's time to dig deeper and listen to America Dissected from Crooked Media, the podcast that's cutting into the science, culture, and policy that shapes our health. From doctors fighting for their rights to the surprising truths about sunscreen, America Dissected dives deep into the state of health. Tune in every Tuesday for new episodes of America Dissected, available on all major podcast platforms.
People probably aren't aware of this because there's so many days in the year, and everything has a day. But this week, we're landing on Rare Disease Day, which I believe is February 29th. So as this comes out, it will be the end of the week, just near the end of the week. And having said that, Jordan, I know you do. You know, like you've stepped into a role of advocacy for HAE, and I'm just kind of curious about. Where that stemmed from, when you decided to advocate as a patient advocate, and what does that look like for you? Like, how do you, how, like, what's the way that you advocate for HAE?
So when I was first diagnosed, I made a YouTube video that was like 15 minutes long, just going through the entire diagnosis, everything that, you know, happened to me, and what HE was, because I didn't want it to happen to someone else. And if someone else was out there experiencing these symptoms, I wanted them to know what it was, because there were so many nights in university, I was Googling these symptoms, watching videos, and I never came across it. And within like a month or two of posting that video, I had people all over the world commenting on it, saying, you know what, what's the test? I think this is what I have. And it started, you know, going places. But 4 years later, HAE Canada, I guess, came across the video and they reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to advocate for them, at like patient, update meetings and at events that they have, if I wanted to be a speaker and talk about my story. So that was really fun. I've gotten to go on a few medical conferences, that they've just been partners with people on. And I, you know, go from conference to conference, just, talking about HAE. The medication that I'm on is called TAC-0. They're made by a company called Takeda, and, they received like a pharmaceutical award. It's one of the highest in Canada, last year for the drug. So I was invited to the unveiling of the award, like the red ribbon cutting ceremony. So that was pretty cool, to represent HAE Canada. Fun. So I don't know. I just, I go to their events. I speak about my story, me and my sister, Gio. I don't think my dad's really gotten into it yet, but I think we're pretty much just like the family, the face to the disease right now.
Well, I mean, you forced him to go get tested, so you might as well just force him onto the stage with you one of these
you
days.
You know, you got a story to tell too.
That's right.
When you're, so did you say your sister was diagnosed after you? What was that experience like having your sister go through something similar and navigating that with her?
So she was sick for years. It just looked really different. Like I said, IBS, it looked like IBS, and it just looked like she had severe stomach issues for years. So for her, it was probably very relieving to have a diagnosis. But it is like very different journeys, because she is still very ill and in the hospital at least once a month. Traveling for her, like over the last, you know, 8 years has been very, very complicated. She hasn't been able to really go anywhere at all. And, you know, medication doesn't work for her. So yes, I know she's happy that she has a diagnosis and she knows what it is, but she doesn't have like the same happy journey that I've had at this point.
Mm-hmm. Do you know from like doing advocacy work for HAE Canada and like being involved in the community, how effective typically these drugs are? Because like obviously with your experience, you know, it's worked really well for you, but your sister and your dad both haven't found effective drug treatments. Is that like standard across the community?
Yeah. So I feel like everyone, well, when I join these HAE Canada patient meetings, it's very interesting to hear which drug everyone's on, because like from province to province, obviously availability differs and what insurance companies will cover. So that's also probably, you know, another big thing that isn't talked about, but I think there's only about like two or three, like if I'm saying in a meeting about 20 people, I would say about only other two to three patients would be on the drug that I'm on. And then what my sister's on, maybe like five. And then what my dad's on, like maybe like five. So everyone in the community is kind of on something different, and it works for them very differently, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It almost reminds me of like, of cystic fibrosis, Jerry, in the sense that like, you know, With your case, Trikafta works for a large portion of the community, but there's people in the community that it doesn't work for, and there's other drugs for those mutations, or some mutations that don't have drugs for them, and it just kind of depends on the variation of the gene mutation.
Yeah,
but I imagine it's like far more complex than just like, you know, assigning one drug and saying like this is the thing that's going to work for all people with HAE.
Yeah,
how did when it comes to your you know, your experience with advocacy, how did that change the way that you relate to your illness?
Knowing that you can help someone just by talking to them and just sharing your experience, asking them what they're going through, just being like, hey, I went through the same thing. How did I cope with it? And just sharing that and knowing that I'm actually helping someone has helped me a lot, because it just makes me feel like I'm not as alone and I'm not as down on myself, and that those bad days and those bad experiences, those long nights in the hospital, it was kind of worth something, not just for me to feel better at the end of the day, but to help someone else feel better. That makes me feel, it makes me feel brave and good inside. And my sister doesn't really take my advice all that much, but I know that when she gets to listen to me talk about it and what I went through, it makes her feel not as alone, because if she was just going through this by herself, I don't know. I don't think she would have made it this far, you know? Like, I feel really bad for her some days, because I don't know how, she's only 4 years younger than me. So at this point, she started when she was 16 as well, and now she's like 24. So it's been going on a lot longer for her. And just because at the end of the day, my case was worse, I was put on life support, doesn't mean that or diminish anything that she's gone through. And I get, you know, all the stories and everyone asks me how I'm feeling, and just because she doesn't really talk about it as much. But I feel like her story, you know, should be shared more, and because there's not always, you know, the happy light at the end of the tunnel. It's not like that for everyone.
Speaking of, you know, the fact that HAE is hereditary, has it influenced your thoughts at all about, you know, genetics and possibly having children in the future? What comes up for you there? When you think about that aspect of your life, if that's something that you've, you know, considered.
So my mother has always told me that I should not have children. She's never wanted me to pass it on because it is genetic. Her point of view is she doesn't want me to have the life she had, which was, you know, growing up with a, you know, toddler baby in the hospital. I feel differently because for her, she had a child who she didn't know was really that ill. She thought, you know, like she was told, right, like these minor illnesses, like RVS and stuff like kids get, right? She was never told that there was something actually wrong with her child, or they may have an autoimmune disease. And so she went living all these years with a child with a rare disease that was undiagnosed. So I get her point of view, going in and out of hospitals, never being told what was really wrong, and then you have to just go right back. And that's probably very, very hard, being in and out of hospitals, never having an answer. But for me, I have an answer. I know what it is, and I know what my child is going to go through. I know what it feels like. I know what it looks like, and I know how to best care for it. I know what you're supposed to do in those situations. So I feel like if I wanted to have a child, I can, and I feel like I'd be prepared to deal with those things. And yes, they're going to get sick, but every child gets sick at the end of the day. And I spent a lot of time in hospitals. So you know what? Taking care of your child is going to the hospital with them. That is a part of it. So I would be very happy to have children. I want to have, you know, a mini me one day. So I'd be okay with it.
I love that. I love that you were able to contemplate and like come to that decision on your own, because, like, you know, on one hand I get it, mom, like I get the idea of like not wanting to see your child have to go through the shit that you went through when she has a kid, but again, like, you're coming into this with the experience that sort of preps you for that experience with a child that might have that experience. So it's like, you know, there's no better mom to have a kid with HAE than a mom that has HAE who knows what it's like to have it. I think that's a really valid point, because like the thought of having children is something that I always thought I would never have children, and it's only been in the last, like, you know, less than a year where I've completely flipped. Like a 180 flip on that thought. And if I had a kid and the kid came into this world with cystic fibrosis, I don't, you know, obviously you'd be like, you don't want your child to be sick, but like I would be, I think I would be like prepared mm-hmm. to handle that and to know how to like navigate that, seeing as how I've it's all I've ever known. So I really like, but I've never thought about it that way until you just said it. So I'm glad
like
you said that.
Obviously, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, it's a really great
but
way
it's
of looking
difficult
at it.
That you are used to.
Right. Right. Exactly.
I have a bit of a maybe a tough question for both of you guys. I think it's great that you're able to, Jordan, that you're able to understand sort of like how your mom's experience with her trauma informs her opinion on that, but also like acknowledge that and then be able to have your own opinion on that. But I'm curious, like if either one of you were considering having a child and, you know, the opportunity was there to do genetic testing before and you found that, you know, whether like how early you can detect it, whether it's in the embryo or shortly after that, you're able to identify that baby that's growing there has either HAE or cystic fibrosis in your case, Jer, would you consider like not having that child?
No.
Well, I'm pretty sure
personally,
when you're having like it. So when we were like, when I was born, HAE was not part of the genetic testing when you're having a kid, but I'm pretty sure in Canada now it is. So I would do it just to like, you know, be prepared. But it wouldn't like sway my decision mm-hmm. either way. If I know yes or no, they're going to have it. I would get the genetic testing done, but it wouldn't change my opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting. And like, I mean, I don't have any strong thoughts or feeling either way. I find it hard to imagine myself in a situation like that.
Would you abort a baby that had ADHD if you could find out it had ADHD in the womb?
No, I think ADHD is a superpower.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So is CF. Yeah. Maybe HAE is too.
Yeah. But
HAE definitely is a superpower. If you want to like punch a motherfucker out, And you just got to scratch your fist like 5 minutes before the fight.
But it wouldn't hurt you. But
you're coming into that motherfucker with a built-in boxing glove. That's right.
But,
yeah.
But to be honest with my thinking about this is like, I also don't think that somebody who chooses not to do that is making a bad decision.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
Like I think that it depends with your level of preparedness to deal with that from either an emotional and mental mm-hmm. Perspective, you know, there's a lot of considerations to make,
totally.
And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't judge anyone for making
decision of course not.
Either way.
And again, like if I had a different experience with CF, where it was like, you know, really, right? I mean, not to say, like I've had a hard time with CF for sure. My experience with it has been tough, but it has been so tough that there's a part of my mind that goes, well, I would never want to subject that to any other being that comes into this world. And I know that there's people out there that have had it so fucking rough that that's probably where their mind would go. And that's totally valid. You know, it's all entirely dependent on your worldview and on your, you know, your past experiences and on, I mean, fuck, it's dependent on like where you're at in that particular moment in time, right? Like 35 years of my life, I was like, I'm never going to have kids. Mm-hmm. And that all of a sudden it just switched. I don't know. I must've watched like watched too many like rescuing like the dodo or some shit, just like puppies being rescued from the street on Instagram or something. I was like, I gotta have a child, I guess. You know,
I also think that we're like biologically programmed to like at this age start thinking about those things in ways that we probably don't think about them until now.
Yeah, probably.
I feel that way.
Yeah.
Like I, for a lot of my life, I grew up thinking like, man, I don't know if I'll ever be equipped to have a kid.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in recent years.
And then sold your Westphalia and got a bunch of money and you went, you know what? Now I think I actually, now I'm not sinking tens of thousands of dollars into my Westphalia every month. I can foresee a life where I can afford a child.
I think getting a dog too and taking care of somebody like that. And because for me, like my ADHD brain thinks a lot about the amount of work and like, things that I'll have to think about with having a kid.
Yeah.
And so it feels overwhelming to think about the idea, but then looking at the example of like taking care of a dog, which obviously is like, you know, far less work than taking care of a human. But I think it gives you a taste of like of that responsibility of like taking care of something that's not just you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And realizing that that it doesn't take away from my life. It actually makes it better in so many different ways.
Yeah.
I think like that sort of more mature way of thinking about it has made me brought me around to the idea of having kids.
I love that this the podcast just turned into like a like let's just fucking like guilt the world into having more babies.
No, it's not about that. I mean, we're not giving anybody
anyone listening telling to this, anybody you better have a kid this. Quick because time's running out. Jordan, I got a two-part question to wrap this up, and it's a question that we ask a lot of our guests. The first part is, what is the biggest thing that HAE has taken away from you?
Good question, but honestly, I really don't think that HAE took anything away from me. Like, I just feel I thought I was normal growing up. Today, I still think I'm normal. I had a really good childhood. I was able to compete in dance. I was able to be a cheerleader. I was able to work. It was a drag being sick all the time and having to go to the hospital, but I don't really think that there was anything really missing from my childhood. And even today, like, I have to do a needle, but I don't think that a needle really takes anything away from my life. So I don't find this disease to be that much of a, I don't think it's taken anything away from me.
What would you say is the biggest thing that it's given you?
It's given me a lot of confidence. It's given me the ability to help people all over the world. It's given me a voice to talk to people like me and to just talk about sickness and hospitals and to share my life with people.
Mm. I'm really surprised you didn't say the ability to make steroid jokes in the gym. Because like I'd totally be in the gym, jabbing my leg and then flexing in the mirror.
We heard it earlier, bro. We get it. That you'd use that joke.
Sorry,
Jordan. You're also an artist, right?
Yes, I sing some songs. I write some songs.
You've got. I'm on your Spotify right now. Looks like you've got like a full album or EP here, a couple singles. I would love to kind of wrap this up, play out the episode to your latest single that's on Spotify, called Hit and Run. And, again, that's Jordan Campbell on Spotify if you want to go check that out. But we'll play the episode out with Hit and Run. And Jordan, I want to say thanks, big shout out. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and chat with us. This has been really awesome. And a reminder again, folks, this week, Rare Disease Day falls on Thursday, February 29th. So you heard an episode here about a rare disease. Now you know that the day is coming up. And so maybe share this episode with somebody that you love, somebody that you know, in order to spread the awareness around one of the many rare diseases that are affecting Canadians and Americans and, you know, world, the humans
world
of the world.
Yeah. World leaders.
World leaders. You know, you never know. Because even though there's a day for everything, it doesn't take away the fact that those days are important. And so, Jordan, we really appreciate you taking time to sit down and share your experience with us. Okay, well, there we go. That was a great conversation, and again, Rare Disease Day is tomorrow, and we probably already said this at the top of the episode, but how funny is it that Rare Disease Day is on February 29th?
Do they only get the day every 4 years?
I don't know. Yeah. I have to talk to the Rare Disease Day people.
Like, is it like an Olympic event?
I don't know.
I feel like maybe they do it on the 28th. Actually, you know what? From an organizational perspective, it's probably easier to facilitate every 4 years. You know?
100%.
It's a little bit less work.
Yeah, it's rare.
So what I would love to, I got something prepped for you guys that I think is going to be very fun. And I want to introduce this by saying we are going to talk about butts, but specifically we're going to be talking about male butts. Okay, so
I thought we were going to talk.
Which I don't think either any of us have wiggle.
I thought we were going to talk about Zendaya,
her butt.
Yeah, you guys haven't seen the meme going around? You guys aren't a part of the meme culture?
No, I'm cutting back on.
All right, well, just look up Zendaya butt.
I'm not going to Google Zendaya butt. It's not bad.
It's not bad.
I got canceled a couple weeks ago for saying that I looked at. Well, you know what? I'm not even going to say it.
You know what? Yeah. Not butt. Don't put butt. Zendaya cheeks.
Also not going to Google that.
Definitely not going to Google that either.
Okay.
So this is a I dived into the fascinating world of research papers that specifically pertain to plastic surgery. And let me tell you, it is much more interesting than most research papers because, and this totally makes sense. I never thought about it this way, but it has a lot to do with like degrees of angles and shape and all this kind of stuff. So this one particular
I understand this now that you said it that way.
Yeah,
I understand it completely because I just bought a 3D printer.
Yeah,
and when you print things on a 3D printer, you have to, like, if you have a right angle and like there's like an overhanging piece, you need to like build in stabilizers for that in the print because it can't like print out directly.
Right.
And I'm imagining that if you're trying to shape a butt, the first thing I think of when you say degrees and angles, I'm thinking like, well, you can't, if you make it like too straight out,
yeah,
then it's not gonna have weird, the support. You're gonna, it's gonna like
a funny butt.
Get like a saggy
you're
butt,
get a clown butt.
Yeah, and so like
Uncanny Valley.
It must be really
Uncanny
difficult.
Valley butt.
Like the math behind getting it to like. It's like
I've seen that in the wild too, and it is uncanny.
Well,
am I right? Is that
kind of? I mean, so this research paper is specifically about it unpacks the ideal male bottom, and it's the first of its kind for a research paper. So the objective here is to define the ideal male buttocks. The buttocks aesthetics.
Is this not hilarious that this is, we're just like in the time of like basically fully deconstructing ideal anything for anybody?
Yeah. So and they did this through crowdsourced analysis. So the methodology was they utilized a crowdsourced online survey distribution where respondents rated digitally altered images of male buttockses. Also, by the way, we're going to get like
buttai, if you will.
Yeah. Buttakai. We are going to get a little bit science jargon heavy. So don't worry. We'll translate this to the Gen Z once we get through this breakdown. Okay. So, you're not going to want to miss it. Okay. So the results, the study identified preferred dimensions and angles that represent the ideal male gluteal aesthetic with no insignificant difference in preferences across respondent sex. The conclusions: findings indicate a preference for a projected, contoured, but narrower male buttock, which could guide future gluteal contouring techniques.
I mean, just from my own personal preferences, I can see that. Because, like, you know, you want it to, like, you want from the side profile it to have that, like, that shape that, like, sort of protrudes out. But also from the front, for the male in particular, you don't want that, like, outward protrusion that like gives it that sort of hourglass.
Right.
So you
you're
want
looking
to be like,
right, wow,
a,
right,
yeah, a slender, right, tight, but
it's kind of like
voluptuous.
It's kind of like an inverse.
Kind of nailed it.
Inverse to female. Like you want to, like you kind of think of V-ing into the hips instead of contouring out at the hips.
So, well, actually, no. So, yes and no. But so, I'm actually going to play you a video.
I'm just thinking from my own personal preference, like
right,
what
yeah,
I would
yeah,
prefer
yeah,
to see.
Yeah.
No, you're thinking of like what everybody should be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's what you're saying.
Yeah,
everybody
I'm saying what everybody should look like.
Right.
Yes.
So I have a video here, and this is also something new to me. I never realized that there's like, I don't know if this is sort of a sort of like marketing ploy for research papers, but like there's this video that was on this research paper website that was like, It was like a video of a somebody who has nothing to do with the study reacting to their to reading the study.
Study reaction videos.
So yeah, so
that's what we do. Guys, that's what we do.
So I'm gonna play this. Oh, man. I'm gonna play this and
that's amazing.
And you're gonna see we're gonna see visuals of exactly what it is that they landed on.
Just FYI, this video
and this is not include nudity. This is fucking full ass nude.
Well, the thing is, this
but
video.
But this is educational.
This is a side note. Asterisk. This video is actually not on YouTube. This episode right now. Our next episode will be fully available on YouTube. So don't be confused by the fact that we're watching videos and talking about them. We're just listen right now.
And also, if you want to watch this video and see the contour glute, maybe we'll actually put a social post up.
Or we could put a link in
this,
the description.
This video exists
or show
on YouTube.
Notes.
Yeah. So let's check this out. Video discussion.
We're not even going to address it.
just
Hi,
listen.
I'm
just
Dr.
Listen.
Michelle Shermack, and I'm a board-certified plastic surgeon in Baltimore. I was asked to comment on a paper written in the Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery Journal, which
why is her face
at
not
the
moving?
Ideal male aesthetic buttock. Different images of male buttocks
look at all those butts.
To alter the level of projection within the buttock, and then these 2,100 respondents were asked to identify their ideal projection. Generally, what was found is that looking at projection from the side and obliquely,
okay, so we got
a fairly
geometry
moderate
happening
level
here.
Of projection was preferred by the respondents.
Yeah.
And from the back, the preference was to see a
narrow
gluteal region with hip dips or trochanteric depressions, a more defined kind of muscular
dimples.
Look.
Dimples on the butt.
And
that's right.
I used to have that.
Varied a bit depending upon age, race, sexual orientation, even employment, body image, where the patients were from. And what is so interesting,
I'm a truck driver.
About
I actually prefer
really
my butts to be
us as
girthy.
Plastic surgeon readers.
A little wider.
Not enough hair on that one.
With patients who come in who are interested in body contouring procedures. What is also interesting is that there's a very different goal in our female patients versus our male patients. And women,
definitely.
The hip dip is out. They want augmentation.
Hip dip is out. Hip dip is no longer hot.
Rounded. Nice peach. Rounded. They want that peach butt.
And again, Gen Zs, just stick around because I will translate all this for you because I know this is
to get to the ideal.
Far too cringe.
Article, and I enjoyed reading it.
She did enjoy that. So, and we enjoyed.
I feel like
your
she
reaction.
Has a little bit too much skin in the game, if you will.
Yeah.
Just saying,
guys. Yeah.
Actually, physically
not,
and professionally.
Guys.
That much skin, actually.
Hey.
It was fairly, her perspective was fairly tight.
Hey, okay, all right, guys, whoa, guys. No.
Dude, well, I think it's important to acknowledge people's biases.
So the results, okay, the results. Demographics, there was 2,095 respondents who chimed in on which butts they preferred to whack off to.
If it was that place's mailing list that was responding to this, then I feel like this study is not credible.
The majority of the respondents were male, so 61% male, age 25 to 35. The ideal aesthetics, so like she said, and this is where it gets kind of nitty-gritty, preferred lateral ratio of 1.18 oblique angle to 60 degrees, and a posterior ratio of 0.66, indicating moderate projection with a defined trochanteric depression. Subgroup variations, notable differences in preferences were observed across regions, like she said, race, sexual orientation, and what their job is, apparently. And then general preference. Both men and women favored a buttock that is more projected and contoured, but with a narrower width.
Yeah.
So the conclusions...
Is that a surprise? Like,
not really.
I mean, when you look at that, you're like, I could see how somebody would think that this is, you know, like based on like... And I'm speaking mostly based off of like, I think... socially our perspectives of what is attractive is shaped by the media, and so like, you know, we see people
not just the media, I mean culture, I think, time,
yeah. Well yeah, like, but like you know what I mean, largely
I know
largely like
yeah,
what
yeah.
what sort of the idea socially of what is attractive is this like kind of,
yeah,
you know, we make this to be certainly some sort of like shared general thing. Yeah. And so like when you look at like, if you were to look at a daytime soap opera guy who's like wearing, you know, briefs and walking down the street, I'm guessing that you could probably guess what his butt would look like.
That's what this is going for.
Right. Yeah. That's what this is pointing towards. It's like showing what we generally prefer.
Like when you scroll through like, an H&M website and you go, oh, that looks nice. Mm-hmm. But then you go to H&M and you try it on you and you go,
God damn it. Why am I so flat?
Yeah. Really doesn't fit.
Why do I not have contoured trochantic dimples.
And the point that I'm trying to make is that we could guess the results of this study based on what we see, because socially, like what we see as an aggregate of like society's expectation of what is
attractive. Well, I mean, people can't see it, but like the example that she showed, the example of like what women prefer. And it's like
for themselves.
Women prefer for themselves. And like that example is very much like when I saw the picture, I went, but the first thing that came to my mind was like, oh, Kim Kardashian, right? Like, and that is like that again to the media part. Like, that is very much like very much plays a fucking role. It's wild. Okay, so to the part where you know all of our young bucks, you can now start to tune back in. We'll get to the translation. Actually, guys, I whipped up a Gen Z translation theme song for these segments.
Fuck yeah!
Great.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go.
Fortnite battle pass. I just shit out my ass, hold it on my PC, cause I need to get that Fortnite battle pass. I like Fortnite, did I mention Fortnite? I like Fortnite, it's night time. Yeah. I mean, 5 o'clock, that's basically night time. Now remember Cartoon Network, Adventure Time.
Yeah, let's go. All right,
I'm actually embarrassed to admit how many times I've heard that song before.
All right, here we go. Gen Z, the abstract. The objective of this study, defining the drip for male booty goals with a crowdsourced vibe check. Okay. So the methodology that they used slid into Amazon MTurk to drop a survey. Peeps rated those edited male booty pics. Okay, and here are the results. Found the most fire dimensions and angles for that ideal male glute aesthetic. And get this, no cap dudes, dudes and dudettes didn't differ on what they stand. Conclusions? Everyone's down for a peachy, snatched, but not too thick male booty, thick with two C's. Setting the bar for future booty glow-ups. Now, here's the background to this, all the context. So we've got zero clarity on what slaps for male booty standards, unlike the heaps of deets on female glute goals. So the need for the study is, with over a mil male glow-ups on... with over a mil male glow-ups in 2019 in the U.S., it's high-key important to catch what male booty aesthetics hit different straight from the source. So here's the methods and the patient. So survey design. Ask the squad about their body type vibes, dimensions, and to rate those booty pics from nah to yas across these three angles, side, kind of side, and back. Measurements. Rolled out with some geeky math, lateral thigh to booty ratio, side angle thing, and booty curve index to measure that booty pop. Oh, this is so hard to read. It feels like reading a different language. Participant demographics. Scooped up all the deets on the fam's gender, age, race, thickness with two C's, who they like, and more. And then analysis tools. Whipped out two-way ANOVA with the Dunnett's clapback for the stats showdown. Okay. So here are the results. The demographics. Got 2,905 peeps weighing in, mostly bros, 61%, and their prime... in their prime, 25 to 34. And a lot of them were white. Ideal aesthetics. The squad is all about that 1.18 side ratio, a 60 degree kind of side angle, and a back ratio of 0.66, giving us that chef's kiss moderate peach with a side of definition. Subgroup amazing. Variations. Found some spicy tea on how these peeps from different places, races, who they heart, their gig, their gym rats, see things differently.
Jesus Christ.
And general preference. Both the guys and gals are here for that peachy projection and definition, but said keep it sleek on the width. So what's next on the docket? The deep dive into male booty aesthetics fills a big old gap in the glow-up science, giving us the 411 on what's peak for the peach. These gems could pave the way for next-level booty sculpting moves, making sure bros walked into the OR or can bros who walked into the OR can walk out feeling 100. Might even drip into how snagging that ideal booty look impacts bros mentally and peeps those satisfaction levels for the long haul.
Nice.
Oh, God.
Thank you for that.
Very telling.
They don't like periods or commas, those Gen Zs, eh?
I'm glad that you put it that way because I feel like that gave me a deeper level of understanding of what now we're talking about. Now I get it. About. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, hope you enjoyed that, folks. And big shout out to our guests today. Happy Rare Disease Day tomorrow. And we won't be coming back to this for another 4 years. So just keep your eyes peeled on that.
That next rare disease episode.
That's it. love your support. Thank you so much. If you want to support the podcast further, rate and review and subscribe. Go on over to YouTube. Leave comments. We're going to be back with our regular YouTube viewing in just over 2 weeks. So we're getting there. And in the meantime, if you want to come hang out on Discord, please do. We'd love to see it. Love to have you there. Our Discord is on Fleek. It is popping 100. Get those V-Bucks. And
that's the tea.
And that's the tea. Of course, if you want to be on the show, sickboypodcast.com. You can go there for any information. If you want to reach out to us or if you want to submit yourself to be a guest, we'd love to have you. And why don't you give a little love to all the peeps
folks
that
who
make
help
this
make this happen
pop off.
Yeah, shout out to Annika, our production assistant, to Donovan, the CPAP Morgan for the sound design, Jeff Lonis, our manager, and to everybody else who helps with this show in the background and in the foreground and in the middle ground. We appreciate all of you.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
Taylor just left, and I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
Do you think we're better off? 'Cause I don't know when enough is enough. I've exhausted all my fuel because I gave it all to you. Ran through the last red light, all because I didn't read the signs in the passenger side. Do you feel guilty now? Got away with it somehow. I ignored all of the flags in your defense and looked green back then. Every time I see your face, it takes me back through time and space. And just so I don't feel so alone, I still sing your favorite song. Ooh, we should be together. Give me up, I'll be kind.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.